So again, good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning, both in the hall and online. We do have an online retreat going on this weekend. About 50 people are involved with Angie, and she's, I think it started Friday night, it's just a weekend on the five skandhas and looking at self and non-self from the point of view of Buddhist psychology, very important. And just a note before we begin, I have had a communication from Jun. Jun is a long-term member of ours and on the board, and she's an infectious disease physician, and she's sort of been our major advisor as we've gone through this, continue to be moving through this pandemic. And what she said recently in her communication was the numbers in Florida are looking better. And so therefore, you know, we've been discussing for a while now about opening things up a little more, especially to non-members. I've felt a little strange since we're bodhisattvas and we want to share and be a refuge for many people that we've only been open to members for a while. So we will, starting next Sunday, be open to non-members, anyone as long as they're vaccinated. And then we'll look at that over time. But, so that's good news. Thank you, Brian. So this morning I wanted to, I don't know if everyone knows, but this past week has been Thich Nhat Hanh's 95th birthday. I think many of you know that a number of years ago he had a significant, massive hemorrhage, and which had left him really without speech and sort of paralyzed in half his body. And so he's been like that for a number of years, and spent several years just being well taken care of in Plum Village and getting treatment. But several years ago he did return to Vietnam. His roots. He's always been a plant kind of outside of its soil. So it's quite nice that in his final years he's returned to his soil and at his root temple where he's been obviously well taken care of. And the news is he is fading. He's more and more spending his days in bed. But you know, if any of you know Thich Nhat Hanh, he does everything very slowly. So the fact that he's dying very slowly, sort of like the tide, just kind of ebbing out, is very congruent with the way he's lived his life. So in honor of him, I wanted to share a little bit of his teachings, but some of his earlier teachings. You know, he sort of rode the wave of mindfulness. He's really the father of mindfulness in the West, and really rode that wave. And so that's really what he's most well known for, you know, as a great exponent of mindfulness, living in the present moment, and, you know, many, many very experimental, creative kind of teachings that he's given over the years. But there, the depth of his teaching as a Zen master is not so well known. So I wanted to return to a book that affected me. It's called Zen Keys. I don't know how many people are aware of, have read Zen Keys. It was originally written in French in, I think, around early 70s. And then actually, I mean, I was a little involved because I had been in I hadn't met him yet, but I've been communicating with him, and he told me about this book, and he was looking for a translator. I translated in English, and we had somebody in the Rochester Zen community who was a Zen practitioner as well as was French-Canadian. So they were fluent in French, Albert Lowe and his wife, so they were the original translators. And also the introduction was written by Philip Kapler, who was my teacher at the time. And actually he allowed me to work with him on that because he didn't really know Thich Nhat Hanh as a person. And I sort of did, through my communications with him. So anyhow, this is the original Zen Keys, $1.95. But this is the newer Zen Keys. And actually, I've compared it a little bit, but actually Thay, which is means teacher, was what Thich Nhat Hanh is called, he revised it in, I think, 1995. So it's not just a reprint, but it's actually a revision. And it's very interesting because I think by then, you know, in 73, he really was not in any way a Dharma teacher in the West. So he really was not that conversant with terminology and of kind of Western Buddhism. But by 95, he certainly was. So he looked obviously revised a translation to really bring it up to date with his teachings and the kind of words that he used. So again, I certainly recommend that everybody take a look at Zen Keys. He is very much you know, a great, you know, I certainly feel that the stream of Dharma that we practice here comes from him. So I want to read a little bit from Zen Keys. I mean, there's a lot, but I guess my emphasis in reading, picking out the things I read, and there's obviously a lot of gems in here, is because I want to give a little different flavor of him than maybe what people are used to. So here's page 25, and actually they're all short. So the book has hundreds of pages. Maybe, well, I shouldn't even say 178 pages, but they're all little, a page or two with all a kind of subtitle. So they're all kind of organized in that way. So this little section is called Necessary Awareness. And he says, in Buddhism, mindfulness is the key. We know he's the grandfather of mindfulness, but it's interesting how he used to talk about mindfulness. Mindfulness is the energy that sheds light on all things and all activities, producing the power of concentration, bringing forth deep insight and awakening. This is not the way mindfulness is utilized or used in so much of secular mindfulness, and I think even in Buddhist groups who teach mindfulness. Mindfulness is the base of all Buddhist practice. So then he elucidates on each of those three points of mindfulness is the energy that sheds light on all things and all activities, produces the power of concentration, brings forth deep insight and awakening. So then he comments on his word, what does it mean to shed light on all things? This is the point of departure. If I live without mindfulness in forgetfulness, I am, as Albert Camus said in his novel, The Stranger, living like a dead person. The ancient Zen masters used to say, if we live in forgetfulness, we die in a dream. And then Thay writes, how many of us live, quote unquote, like a dead person? The first thing we have to do is to return to life, to wake up and be mindful of each thing we do. Are we aware when we're eating, drinking, sitting in meditation, or are we wasting our time living in forgetfulness? So this is kind of foundation, right? There is many Dharma doors that we can enter more deeply in the Dharma. But the one door for everyone is the Dharma of the door of mindfulness. Right? Are we willing to be present as much as we can to life that's unfolding right in front of us? It sounds so simple when I say it, so obvious. You know, I mean, are we, and to be present doesn't just to say, I am aware that I'm talking to you, you see. I mean, that could pass for mindfulness, you know, or I'm aware that I'm looking at Jose. But I could be doing that like over here, like a concept, you see? Or am I really looking at Jose without any thoughts, you see? Just looking. When we have a direct experience, that is mindfulness, right? We are truly mindful, which means we're truly absorbed. We're not filtering the experience through verbiage. And so whether that's an encounter with another human being, whether that's an encounter with nature, whether that's an encounter with our children, whatever the encounter is, are we totally present? Right? So this is his first. It's a light, you see. Light lights things up. When you light things up, you can see what's there. When we turn on the light in the dark, we can see what's there. When we turn on the light of mindfulness, we can really see the person, right? So let's, because even in our interactions with people, they're all filtering through concepts, ideas about who they are, or, you know, we like them, we dislike them, we're happy to see them, we're not happy to see them, we're angry at them, we're, you know what I mean? Those are the filters, you know, and they get in the way of us just seeing the person right there as they are, right? So this is where it begins, you see, that direct encounter with life, right? Because it's interesting that he quotes Camus. You know, Camus was one of the great French existentialists. I was living in France at the time, you know. If we live in forgetfulness, oh no, sorry, that was the Zen masters, but Camus said in his novel that people live like a dead person. A dead person is what? Someone who's not alive. So obvious. But the question is, we have to ask ourselves, do I really live my life like I'm alive? And like my encounter with everything is an encounter with life, you know, very direct, very alive. Or do I go through life like a dead person, like a zombie, like a sleepwalker, right? So in other words, we may be going through the motions of life, right? Getting up, doing whatever we need to do, brushing our teeth, going through our work, fulfilling our responsibilities, work, family, relate, you know what I'm saying? But are we really doing it with, you know, presence, seeing what's really there, hearing what we're really. So this is, it shed lights on all things. And the second thing he said about mindfulness is it produces the power of concentration. So mindfulness helps us focus our attention on and to know what we are doing. So mindfulness, traditionally, it Smriti means remembering, you see. I remember. You see, to focus my attention on whatever I'm saying I'm focusing my attention on, right? And he then goes on to say why that's so important, why that ability is so important, to be mindful of what we're doing and to always hold that in our awareness, because it's so easy to lose it, right? We all know that. It's so easy to lose it. He says, usually we are prisoner of our society. Our energies are dispersed here and there. Our body and mind are not in harmony. To begin to be aware of what we are doing, saying, and thinking is to begin to resist the invasion by our surroundings and by all our wrong perceptions. So, there is a present moment reality, right? Like right now, we would say, all of us are sharing this present moment reality, right? We're here. People online can see it, but so people online are having their own present moment, but what they're doing is we're seeing something and we're hearing something and we're present to something, right? This is our experience, right? But he talks about an invasion by our surroundings, right? when a country is invaded, it means the enemy has gotten beyond the boundaries. We're being invaded, you see. And our own body mind, our own awareness is so easily invaded because it's always being bombarded by external stimuli, by other people, by situations, by the news, right? I'm saying we're endlessly bombarded by the external world, which can be big external world, or it could be just others, their stuff, right? I mean, that's not bad or good. It's just acknowledging, yeah, there's a lot of bombardment going on. We are constantly being invaded. As well as, he says, we're being invaded by our wrong perceptions. So many of us distort things. We have all kinds of filters. We have all kinds of issues. So we're, you know, right? So it's like, can you see how, in a certain sense, difficult it is? If we don't have mindfulness, if we don't have concentration, so easily it is to be just tossed about by the external world, people, situations, and tossed about by our own conditioning, our own wrong perception, our own issues. When the lamp of awareness is lit, our whole being lights up, and each passing thought and emotion is also lit up. So it is a light. It doesn't mean we have to stop everything and control everything, but it means we are at least aware of what is going on. We're aware of what's going on in our mind. We're aware of our thoughts. We're aware of our emotions, right? In the middle of all the movement of thought, of emotion, of situations, of people, of surroundings, of work, of deadlines, of, you know what I mean? In the middle of all that, there is, I'll use the word somebody, something that is present and aware. It's kind of holding the fort, so to speak. We're using the term of, you know, somebody holding the fort. Self-confidence is reestablished. The shadows of illusion no longer overwhelm us, and our concentration can develop to its fullest. We wash our hands, we dress, we perform everyday actions as before, but now we are aware of our actions, words, thoughts, deeds. Okay, so that's kind of this fundamental transformation. It's not like we've retreated from the world. It's not like we're still outwardly, we don't look the same. We still get up in the morning, we still do whatever we do. You know what I mean? We go about a day, we go to work, we take care of relationships, we fulfill our responsibilities. It's just like before, except there's somebody home, you see. There's somebody manning the fort, right? So we're not just pushed this way and that way. You know, modern times we call being pushed this way and that way, we call that what? Stress, right? We call that stress. You know, so many people, everything stresses them out. Work stresses them out. Their family stresses them out. Their relationships stress them out, right? People just stress. But what are they stressed by? Just this movement of life. But if there's nobody home who's aware of what's going on and you know, has a ground, you know, I guess that's what I would say, you know, has a ground, right? It's just like when we did our meditation today, which is where we learn how to be mindful. You know, we establish mindfulness of body. We establish mindfulness of breath, right? We do that, mindfulness and concentration, so as the thoughts, as the sensations, as the emotions, the memory, whatever is moving through our mind, we're not, what? Swept away. We have a ground, we have stability. And that builds confidence in what? It builds confidence in yourself, right? You know, I can stand my ground, whatever it is, whatever, whoever you are, I can stand my ground. I know who I am. I'm aware. I have my values. And all these stuff that's going on from, you know, coming up from my past or all the stuff that's coming from the external world, I'm not tossed around on, right? I'm going to see it all clearly. And then the third one was to bring forth deep insight and awakening. The aim of Zen Buddhism is a clear vision of reality, seeing things as they are, and that is acquired by the power of concentration. This clear vision is enlightenment. Enlightenment is always enlightenment about something. It is not abstract. So again, he's giving us an interpretation of mindfulness. Can you see that goes so much further than the way it's often taught and presented? You know, it's a mindfulness that establishes oneself in the present. It's a mindfulness that has the light of concentration to light up everything and to see what it is. So one develops self-confidence and stability and an inner strength and a groundedness. And then it's to give us insight into really what's going on, understanding. And he'll say more about later, right? And again, that's... You know, the problem is when we read about, and we'll hear a little more about awakening, enlightenment, freedom, right? It all sounds wonderful, right? But as he says here, unfortunately, it takes some concentration. You know, it's like anything else we want to develop. We want to develop some work skill or some ability or some hobby or some sport or some music, you know, whatever cooking, you know, whatever it is that we want to become good at, we have to give it some concentration. Well, we have to give it some time, some energy, some focus. We all know that. And many of us have devoted endless hours to developing that, right? Those skills and competencies in all these areas of our life, countless hours. But how many hours of, how concentrated are we on our own spiritual development transformation? I mean, that's a question for us to ask ourselves. You know, but it's like anything else, you know, you want to become a great musician or you want to become a good musician. Well, how many hours do you practice a day? I mean, isn't that kind of an obvious question, right? If you really want to become really good at this and you practice 20 minutes a day, a half hour a day, unless you're a genius, you know, unless you're a Mozart or something, you know, I don't think it's going to happen, right? You know, I mean, there is a relationship to concentration, which means paying attention, a continuous kind of attention. And it doesn't only mean just, you know, sitting in concentration. It means as we move through our day, we don't lose the concentration of what we just talked about. You know, we don't lose our concentration on being aware of our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions, and not getting caught up in them, not being swept away by them, staying grounded, staying present, you know, knowing who we are, right? See, that takes concentration. So don't think concentration is just, again, on, you know, an aspect of formal meditation. We need concentration if we want to develop anything, and especially if we want to transform our minds. And he actually, in this one called "Seeing Into One's Own Nature," he talks very directly. And this is the way when I encountered him in the 70s and early 80s, I mean, this is the way he taught. But again, over time, as he became more popular and more and more popular and more and more popular, And people, he really understood kind of how messed up we all were, say mildly, you know what I mean? And just scattered we were, and just how out of touch we were, right? With our own body, minds, and how out of touch we were with other people and our relationships. He sort of just focused on that one piece, you see, because he really saw the need. But I'm sharing this to see, oh, but his original, I mean, he's a Zen master. But his life took him in a more popular direction. He's talking about an enlightened person. Someone who has attained perfect self-mastery, complete freedom, tremendous spiritual power that allows them to regard happiness, unhappiness, and all the vicissitudes of life with absolute calmness and clarity. The essence of this does not come from a position taken philosophically, but it comes from a deep insight into one's own mind and the living reality of life. When one has reached this enlightenment, one sees all wrong views dissolve within oneself. A new vision produces a deep peace, great tranquility, and a spiritual strength characterized by the absence of fear is born. And then he says very clearly, seeing into one's own nature is the goal of Zen. He's a Zen master. We are practitioners. We are the Florida community of mindfulness. We're watered by the great traditions of Zen. What is the purpose? Seeing into our own nature. How simple. How simple. It's our own nature. Right? I don't have to see into your nature. I don't have to go anywhere. I just have to be able, I have to be willing to be mindful in concentration and to look deeply into my own mind. Who am I? Who am I really? I know I'm aware of thoughts, I'm aware of feelings, I'm aware of my narrative, I'm aware of my stories, I'm aware of my likes and this, you know, I'm aware of all that, right? But what is it that's aware? What is that, you see? I know I have lots of thoughts, but who's the thinker? Who's thinking the thoughts? See? What is that? So that's what we're talking about. You know, when they talk about the nature of mind, they're really talking about the nature of this, right? Because all of us right now, we're experiencing this whole experience, right? So this is an experience, right? We're all having an experience now? You would grant me that, right? So we're all having the experience of that. And we would all understand that we're all having this experience because of our mind, right? I mean, nobody's experiencing it through their big toe, right? Through their elbow, right? Through their liver. No, we're experiencing it through our mind. So what is the nature of this mind? Because it is the basis of everything. It is the basis of this experience. What is it? Is it something solid? Is it a thing? Does it have any characteristics? Is it like a physical thing that's born and dies, comes and goes? Or is it something much more profound and deep like that than that, you know? Something much more transcendent. Something beyond birth and death. Wouldn't that be interesting? See, we all know the thoughts, but we don't know the nature of the thinker. We all know the cognitive mind, but we don't know the mind of pure awareness, you see. So we want to see into our own true nature. I mean, forgive me if these sounds, it's really kind of simple. Okay? Because right now we're all aware, right? I mean, the only reason we know we're having an experience is because we're aware. You know, this awareness is like a light, you know? When it comes out the eyes, it manifests as seeing. When it comes out the ears, it manifests as hearing. When it comes out the nose, it manifests as smelling. When it comes out the mouth, it manifests as tasting, right? When it manifests in the body, it manifests as physical sensations, right? When it manifests in the thinking mind, it manifests as thoughts. Those are all its manifestations. What is the source of this light? What is the source of this awareness? What is the nature of this? Anyhow, it's another matter. Now, this is a little section called Not Self. I mean, interesting his language then, you know. See, my early encounters with Thich Nhat Hanh was he was very gentle, right? You know, and I think that's part of that is the Vietnamese culture. He's very gentle and sweet, but he worked me over. So you know, I saw him differently. So he says, listen to this, he says, the Buddha used the notion of not self. So we know that's a very fundamental notion idea, you know, this idea of not self. Nothing has a permanent, solid self. Everything is just made up of causes and conditions. I mean, I'm not sure what Angie's teaching, but that's what I'm sure she's teaching this weekend. I mean, the five skandhas are the five psychophysiological aspects of a human being, body and mind, right? And yet, when we investigate our body and mind, we can find nothing solid, nothing permanent. The body just made up of parts. The mind, we find thoughts, feelings, perceptions, consciousnesses, all these different things. But we can't find anything solid. We can't find a self, a solid thing. So not self is a very, you know, it's like one of the major fundamental tenets of Buddhism. There is no solid self. It may appear like one, but upon a investigation, you don't see anything. So the Buddha used the notion of not self, Thich Nhat Hanh writes, to upset and to destroy. Now, we're not used to Thich Nhat Hanh talking this way, are we? Right? He's so sweet. He's so kind. He's so gentle. People love him. Right? The Buddha used the notion of not self to upset and destroy. Later, he used it to expound his teaching of awakening. It can thus be said that the notion of not self is the point of departure of Buddhism. And then he sort of defines it. Anyhow, he goes into the whole teaching on non-self. But it's just interesting, again, his language, right? And I think this is very important. You know, we want our teachers to be very gentle with us, don't we? To be very understanding of us, to be very accepting of us, right? And that's fine. That's good. But we also want our teacher to help wake us up, you see. And sometimes, you know, it's good to be upset, right? It's good to kind of get a teaching and go, hold on a second, not self? What? I have based my whole life on myself, right? I mean, every issue I have in my life that I bring from childhood right to the present is based on me and the way I see the world, right? And my needs and my wants, right? I mean, that's kind of the basis of everything. And all of a sudden, they're teaching the self doesn't really exist and the identification with it, that is the source of suffering. I thought the source of my suffering was the way myself has been treated in this life. You see, I thought that was the source of my suffering, right? I thought the source of my suffering because I can't get what I want in this life, right? Things aren't going my way in this life. That's what I thought the source of my suffering is. And if only things could go my way and everything could be, you know, hunky-dory. And all of a sudden, you get teachings. No. The problem is you identify with the self and all the things that have happened, you've incorporated in your story of self. It's the story that's causing us to suffer. It's the identification that's causing us to suffer. So again, when we hear these teachings, we should go, we should be upset. Right? You see? You know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, you know, what's it like? It's like you bought a, you know, they still do that, you know, when you buy a car and it's been misrepresented and it's really terrible, it's called a lemon. Remember that, you know? And you remember how upset you were. Why were you upset? Because you were fooled. You were betrayed. Somebody told, oh, this is a fine car, it runs well. and a day later you're driving somewhere and the whole thing just kind of, you know, overheats. Or, you know what I'm saying? You go, it's, and you take it to the shop and the guy says, no, it's terrible. It's terrible. I bought a lemon. Could it be that we've bought a lemon in this life? You see? It's like, you know, we've been told, do this, do this, do this, do this, and everything will be what? Hunky-dory. We'll be happy. You know, we just, right? And many of us have done all that. And yet we realize, hold on a second. This is not turning out the way it was supposed to turn out. You see? Right? In the world of Disney, everything has a happy ending. Lately, I've been reading to my grandchildren stories from Hans Christian Andersen, the Grimm brothers, if you ever read those. And then if you see the Disney version of the same thing, very different. They don't all have happy endings, you know? So it's interesting, you know, anyhow. So, yeah, the notion of not self to upset and destroy. Destroy what? Our false views, our wrong notions, our misidentifications, right? We should be upset, I mean, initially. Wow, I really, you know. I thought this was the road to take me to Shangri-La, and it's taking me to where? Got to be careful what I say. But anyhow, it's not Shangri-La. To return to our true home, to see into our own nature, is the aim of practice. This is Thich Nhat Hanh. This is the aim of practice. We see into our own nature by bringing light to each act of our existence, living in a way that mindfulness is present all the time. He refers, the cypress tree, I think this chapter is on the side. There's a very famous koan in the Chinese tradition where somebody asks this master, I forget, like what is, what is the highest truth of Buddhism? And the master says, the cypress in the courtyard. Very famous. We see into our own nature by bringing light into our active existence. And in this book, actually, there's a lot of koans. I mean, Tai used to, he grew up, you know, studying koans. You know, he's familiar, he just hasn't taught. We see into our own nature by bringing light to each act of existence, living in a way that mindfulness is present all of the time. When walking past the cypress tree in the courtyard, we really see it. If we do not see the cypress tree in our own garden, how can we expect to see into our own true nature? Now, what does it mean to see the cypress tree in the garden? Somebody might go, hold on a second. Anybody can see the cypress tree in the garden, right? It's so pedestrian. But he's talking about something very different. Usually when the ordinary mind sees a cypress tree in the garden, it's like, I'm here seeing the cypress tree over there. But the mind that has experienced the truth of things, the cypress tree and the seeing and the one who is seeing are no longer separate. And when you see the cypress tree, you don't just see the cypress tree, you see everything. You know, Tai often says, you know, in that cypress tree, everything is present. The whole universe is present. You know, when we see the cypress tree, do we see it as a static thing or do we think it as a living thing that's growing, that's alive, that's connected to the earth, that comes from a seed, that is nurtured by the rain and the sky and the sun? You know, everything is there. Now, that sounds like a concept, but it's an experience when there's no separation. A Zen master who has attained awakening is someone whose eyes are open to living reality. She is someone who, after being lost in the world of concepts, has returned home to see that the cypress tree in the courtyard is no different than her own nature. Hence, she cannot allow her disciple to continue to wander in the world of concepts and waste their life, their own possibility of awakening. This is why the master feels compassion every time her disciple asks a question about some Buddhist principle, such as, oh, what about this, and what about the Dharmakaya, and what about the blah, and da, da, da. She thinks, this young person still wishes to engage in the search for reality through concepts. And she does her best to extricate the student from the world of ideas and put them in the world of living reality. Look at the cypress in the courtyard. And then he does it again with exclamation. Look at the cypress in the courtyard. So it's interesting. You know, again, it's, you know, what is the function of a teacher? In Zen, the function of a teacher is to help us wake up, to help free us. Free us from what? Free us from living in dead ideas, dead concepts, right? Which is what we want. We want to come alive. And so it is the role of the teacher to help us, not indulge us. If a teacher indulges us, indulges our endless, you know, our endless attachment and stuckness in all our issues, our endless attachment and stuckness in all our ideas about life, right? Those aren't real things, you see? Like, everybody has issues, right? Everybody here have issues, some issues? Some people have a lot of issues? Look right now, where are they? Where are your issues right now? I mean, look, open your eyes. Do you see your issues here? Maybe you're thinking, oh, maybe they're behind me. So just turn and look behind you. Maybe they kind of, you know, they got lost or something, you know. You know, when you leave here, or people online, you know, go look around in your car, you know. You know, maybe they're, no, we can't find our issues. To find our issues, we have to what? What do you have to do to find your issues? Yeah, you have to close your eyes and think about them. You have to remember them. What are my issues? Interesting. What if we just forgot about them? Wouldn't that be interesting? Maybe that's the mind of a Buddha. No issues. No problem with anything. Just present. Just dealing with whatever appears before them. So the first section of the book is very much like I'm sharing, you know, very much sharing the concepts of Zen. The middle is is a little deeper. He really shares a lot of Buddhist philosophy, Nagarjuna, a lot of you know deep concepts around non-self and all that. It's very profound. And then the end of the book, it's called The Regeneration of Humanity. And we know that, you know, Thay is well known among many things for his the idea of engaged Buddhism, right? You know, that it's a Buddhism that has to be involved in life and society and relationships. But when he was young, he was concerned about the regeneration of humanity. Big mind. And this is a section called Zen and the World of Today. Our picture of an enlightened person is of someone very free, who possesses spiritual strength and is not pushed around by the currents of society. The practitioner, once enlightened, sees herself in her true nature, knows herself, and possesses a clear view of reality, the reality of her being and of her social situation. This vision is the most precious fruit Zen can offer. So again, he's putting forth, you know, the aim of our practice is to become enlightened, right? Now that could be very scary for some people. Go, whoa, you know, a little more mindful, a little less neurotic, a little more grounded, right? That sounds pretty good, but enlightenment, is there any way we kind of whoa? That's like, what do they say? You know, it's way beyond my pay grade. But it's not, you see. I mean, to be fully enlightened, I mean, there are degrees of enlightenment, to be fully enlightened in this lifetime, maybe that's to be fully transformed. But to be enlightened as to, you know, to have the light on. We can all have the light on. There's no barrier to that. The light on that we can see clearly. But then wherever we are in life, we can just see clearly what's going on. We're not buffeted by, again, the winds of our past and our conditioning. We're not buffeted by the conditions and the whims of other people. We're not even buffeted about by society and all the currents that are endlessly changing in our society, you know, political and social. The enlightened person's way of being is the most fundamental and beneficent contribution to society and all life that one can make. Right? Do you hear this? This personal transformation is the most important way that we can contribute to society. Because he says, Zen is a living tradition that produces stable, healthy, balanced people. I mean, there are many wonderful ideas for social improvement, aren't there? That are, you know, always available to us, and many people devote lots of time to them. And yet what? Who's producing stable, stable, healthy, balanced human beings? You could have all kinds of social movements, you could have all kinds of positive political social change, but if human beings aren't able to live in a healthy way within their own minds and with each other, it's all going to just endlessly fall apart because of why? Because of the nature of human minds and people's delusions, and they're just being buffeted about, and they're so easy. I mean, look what's going on in our society right now. People are so easily manipulated, aren't they? Their minds are so, you know, right? Right? I mean, things that seem to be so apparent, like facts, people don't believe, do they? Why is that? Because people's minds are there's no groundedness. There's no stability. They don't live in reality. They live in what? Thoughts, concepts, ideas. And so do all the rest of us. But there are many people who are so ungrounded that they're, you know, they can be so easily manipulated, right? By the currents of ideologies. I mean, this is why Thich Nhat Hanh, I mean, his first precepts in the Order of Interbeing was, you know, don't be attached to your views. He thought, you know, in the 20th century, this is the most dangerous thing. I mean, he was like he could see it. You know, attachment to views, he said, because he just lived through Vietnam, the war. He goes, wow, people kill each other for ideologies, right? In the good old days, people used to kill each other for what? You know, for like land. You know what I mean? You know, like real things, you know, land, I'm going to grab your land, or I'm going to, you know, get your wealth. You see what I'm saying? I'm being facetious, of course, when I call it the good old days. But all of a sudden, he saw a new phenomena. People were killing for ideologies. People were killing for ideas. You see? And that's very different, much more dangerous. So again, I'm not saying anything negative against positive social change, but I'm saying, who's going to produce the healthy, stable people, the wise, compassionate people who can live in society and demonstrate what it really means to be a human being? See, who's going to do that, you see? And Thich Nhat Hanh says, that's our job. That's our tradition, right? Wherever we show up in life, can we show up as a healthy, balanced, open, caring, compassionate human being, wise, stable? As Thich Nhat Hanh said so many times, you know, he talked, and forgive me because I've said this before, but it's, you know, I mean, he talked about the boat people, right? And you know, all the ones fleeing by boats and, you know, being on the high sea. I mean, it's going on right now, right? I mean, with so many refugees. You know, and he said, you know, when everybody's scared, when the storms, when they're, you know, there's got to be somebody in the boat who doesn't give in to fear and confusion, right? There's got to be somebody who's solid and stable, who can really be there for others, right? I mean, who's going to be that person? Well, he says, that's our job. That's the job of Zen. That's the job of our tradition, to produce these kinds of people. And how do we do it? Well, first we do it with ourselves, right? That's our first job. To become that person and begin to show up in our life, wherever it is, in our family, in our relationships, in work, and, you know, wherever we are we showing up that way? Yeah, he was quite a social thinker back then. Contemporary human beings are dragged along in a producing and consuming treadmill to the point where they begin to become a part of a machine and they lose mastery of themselves. Daily life dissipates their spirit, eats up their time, and thus doesn't leave the opportunity to become aware of themselves and return to their deeper self. Accustomed as we are to being so constantly occupied, if these occupations, all the things that occupy our time and mind, are taken away from us, we often find ourselves feeling empty and abandoned. Still, we refuse to confront ourselves and instead go off in search of friends, to mix in with the crowd, to listen to the radio, TV, to get rid of these impressions of emptiness. Present-day life, agitated to the extreme, makes us so easily irritated. Emotions overwhelm us many times a day, dominate and possess us. If we're no longer ourselves, how can we say that it is we who is living and deciding our life? Very insightful. Yeah, then I... Am I teaching next week? I don't know either. Anyhow, if I am, I'll continue. But it's just, I feel like I'm rushing. I wanted to take questions and get a discussion, but I can see. And now there's another section called, I mean, are you with me? Are you enjoying this? Yeah, this is good. In this section, he says, is awakening possible? The problem that faces us is the problem of awakening. I thought the problem that's facing us is the infrastructure. Right, isn't it? Isn't that what the headlines are about these days, the infrastructure bill? I'm not minimizing that, but it's just interesting, right? Now, I mean, again, not to say that these issues, you know, of infrastructure and, you know, and climate, I mean, these are issues, but he says the problem that faces us is the problem of awakening. What we lack is not an ideology or a doctrine that will save the world. What we lack is mindfulness of who and what we are, of what our real human situation is. We need to wake up in order to rediscover our human sovereignty. We are riding a horse that is running out of control. And it's interesting. And he says, the way of salvation is a new culture in which human beings are encouraged to rediscover their deepest nature. What does that mean? You know, we call ourselves the Florida Community of Mindfulness, right? Community. You know, community is we want to create a culture here. Not like a culture that's not part of the world, you see what I'm saying? But a culture that nurtures us, that supports us. I mean, we have to be part of a culture so we can get the nurture, support, the training, so we can develop ourselves to our full capacities. Because it's, as he says, the world, and we all know that, right? The world, the worldly life, right? The world of our work and our families, they occupy a lot of our time, don't they? A lot of our energies. I mean, that just seems to be the way it is in modern society. It's funny, we, you know, do you remember like technology and, you know, inventions were supposed to make life easier? We're supposed to have more leisure time. If you ever go back like to the 40s and things and you see the advertisements for like washing machines, right? You know what I mean? Dishwashers. They're all about what? They're going to liberate women. Don't take this the wrong way. They're going to liberate, from having, you know, all the, you know, the vacuum. Right? You see, all this stuff was to liberate people so they'd have more time, more leisure. Right? You see, all so much of the technology. Do you remember? I remember when computers first came in. Oh, all this time we're spending, you know, juggling files, you know, and all this paperwork. It's all going to go. Right? You see, we're going to have just so much more time. Is that true? Anybody work these days and say, oh, yeah, it's. Yeah. Gee, it's a 5-hour work day. They pay me the same because we have just so much more. Right? It's not true. So we have to, you know, look more deeply, my friends, into what's going on in this life and what's really important. And how can I, you know, again, if we want to be nurturers of others, and we all do, you know, we're all in families, we're all in relationships, we're all at the workplace, we're all in society, right? We want to be able to nurture, right? And bring positive energy, right? to all the, you know, all our interactions with the world. But, you know, what's going to nurture me, you see, to become that person? Just, you know, I can want it, I can believe it, right? But I need, you know, I need the reality of you know, of that support. And that's what community does, right? You know, and that's what we need to create, our institutions that teach how to teach human beings how to wake up, how to be free, how to return to themselves. Because it's not taught out there, is it? So anyhow, so anyhow, next time I present, I'll continue with Thai. But Zen keys. $1.95. $12.95. In Canada, it's $19.95. Really? The Canadian dollar is not doing well. All right, we'll just take a few. Any questions or comments? There was five. Yes, Jose. Is it short? I mean, can I just repeat it quickly? I mean, it's okay. So Jose's saying he found the concept of destroy and upset very interesting.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of something I read about
Thai. I'm just speaking for, we have a lot of people online. So Jose's saying it reminds him of something that he once read that Thai had said, yes.
And he said, when you find the Buddha, kill him.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's a very famous saying in Zen, but you gotta be careful, but go on. Yeah, if you find the Buddha, you have to kill the Buddha. Well, he's talking about a very famous saying, if you find the Buddha, but this is, you know, so this is a very famous Zen saying. It what it means is, again, it's sort of what Thay say, you know, that ultimately the purpose of practice is we stand on our own two feet. We know the truth. Right? And we're self-reliant in the best way. And so, you know, we don't need the Buddha to tell me that I'm right. You see, we don't need the concept of Buddha. You see, we don't need the concept of teacher. We don't even need the concept of Dharma. In the beginning, we need all these concepts, right? Because they help us. Oh, to know the Buddha's up there and he's a representative of enlightenment. And when I bow to him or I'm following his way, you see, that's when you're on the path, that's very helpful. But at a certain point, it won't be helpful because you'll still be reliant. So it's sort of like at the end, you know, if the Buddha shows up and tells you anything that, you know, you have, it's like my teacher once said to me, he said, you know, I know the nature of my mind. And he said, if the Buddha showed up and told me I was wrong, I would tell him he's wrong. Now that's, I mean, he was a, you know, a Buddhist monk, not easy to tell the Buddha he was wrong, but it meant what he was, he used as an example of, but you know, I'll tell you another little Zen story along your lines. So there is this, I forget what he was. He was some kind of Zen student, came to the Zen temple to meet this teacher. And of course, you know, there is this usual, you know, they have meditation and ritual. And in the meditation and ritual, you know, the monks are bowing to the Buddha, they're prostrating to the Buddha. And this, whoever he was, I don't know if he was a monk or some kind of Chinese intellectual or something, I don't know, Japanese intellectual or something. But, you know, when he had his interview with the teacher, he says, he was furious. He said, I can't believe this is the tradition of Zen, you know, where the Zen master said, if you meet the Buddha, kill him. You know what I mean? Where there's a story of this Zen master once who, you know, I guess there was something, but they needed warmth or something. So he said, all right, take the Buddha and burn it, you know, to create heat or something. I mean, you know, it was that act of compassion. So he said, this is the tradition, you know, where they, you know, they threw the Buddha in the fire. right? And the master says, you know, you may want to throw the Buddha in the fire. I'd rather bow to him. I'd rather bow to him. So again, you know, all Buddha's teachings are situational, right? So someone who's attached, right? The master says, cut off your attachment. But to another person, he says, that's good. You prostrate to the Buddha. That's very good. It's good for you. So, Buddhism is not like catechism. It's very situational. At a certain point, it's very important to have trust and faith in the path because it moves us along. But over time, it can get in the way. You see, like being a child. You know, when you're a young child, you have to listen to your parents. You know, because you don't have it all together yet, even though teenagers think they do. You know, so you have to, you know, you listen. But if you're a good parent, over time, you want to, you know, give them more freedom and begin to let them make their own mistakes, right? So you change because what might have been helpful, right? Like if you hold your child when they're learning to walk, that's what? Helpful. But if, you know, they're 8 years old and you're still holding them when they walk, it's no longer helpful. You see? It's sort of like that, you see? So at certain times, it's good to be, you know. But at the end, it's good to do it, you know. You know, in Zen they say, in the beginning of practice, you think mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. But that's a dualistic view. Then you practice. And in the middle of practice, you don't know anything. You know, you don't think mountains aren't mountains, rivers aren't rivers. I don't know what's even going on here, right? But at the end, he says, you can come back. Rivers are just rivers, mountains are mountains. But that's like the cypress in the courtyard, right? So it's like that. Any other quick questions? No? Good. We will end for today and wish Ty a happy birthday. By the way, they did send out from Plum Village, and again, it's hard to know since Ty doesn't speak, so I'm not sure, but basically his wish for anybody who feels connected to him was the best way to celebrate his birthday, to honor his birthday, was to practice deep listening. That was the gift he wanted from his students. You know, wherever you are in life, whoever you're in relationship, practice deep listening with them. Deep listening is a practice of mindfulness. Totally present, totally aware. Stop thinking, just listen, be present, see them, hear them as they are. So that was his wish for us. Happy birthday, Ty.